Walk a mile in someone else's shoes. The Guest Room on ABC Local Radio across the Territory.
Kate O'Toole with you, and it is great to have your company today. Now, think of your very best idea, the best idea you've ever had in your life. Now, would you be willing to bet your house on that? Today's guest did just that. Posy Graham-Evans is the creator of McLeod's Daughters, one of Australia's most popular drama series. She mortgaged herself to the hilt twice to make that show a reality. Posy's going to take us from her humble beginnings as a prop buyer and cable dragger to being one of the most successful women in Australian television. But it doesn't stop there. These days, she often finds herself daydreaming of England and the 19th century, and even further back than that, she's found another outlet for her creativity and imagination as a novelist. And her most recent book is called The Dressmaker. Posy Graham-Evans is in the guest room with us next after her first musical selection. And I just wanna wish you well. I just wanna wish you well. Welcome, swallows, dip and swing. Take the cue from the slightest thing. Rolling fog into my room. Why'd you give up on me so soon? Very upbeat start to our guest room today. Wish You Well by Bernard Fanning and Posy Graham-Evans. Welcome to the guest room.
Hello. Hello, Kate.
Can you tell
us? Story of my life, that song.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love it.
Can you describe, why did you pick it out for us in particular?
Oh, well, because it is very up, but it actually has a layer to it, which is about heartbreak. But it's incredibly energy driven and I have a weakness for a pop anthem, always have, but I just one of the reasons I really like a good pop song is the best of them kind of get you singing along, won't get out of your head, but my God, there's a sting in the tail. But I want to wish you well, you know, I just want to wish you well. I think that's the only attitude you can have in life, because you fall flat on your face plenty of times, and I think the longer my life continues, the more able I am to reflect on the failures and make use of them, actually. God, it's a lot to get out of a little
some
song. But
diversity of music to expect in the next hour as well. We'll hear Into My Arms from Nick Cave. And we'll also hear from Joan Baez. We'll hear and sort of have a bit of a flowers in our hair moment too. Now, is that a story from your life? Did you have flowers in your
in my hair?
Hair?
You bet I did. You know, How do you look back? You only see the landscape of your life later. And I've always lived, it seems to me, one of my greatest strengths and greatest weaknesses is that I'm an experiencer. I tend to live in the present. So looking back, you bet, I was a genuine double-dyed hippie. And the Indian dresses, the baby on the hip, the long waist-length hair, even the combi.
And the commune.
Oh, yeah. My first husband was a potter. I was a potter's wife. And in not even a misguided moment, plenty of people thought it was misguided at the time, in the mid-70s, we ran away to New Zealand with the combi and the baby and a washing machine in the back of the combi, which we didn't succeed in ever plugging in because there was no power where we went. Yeah, and we went to the Coromandel Peninsula in the middle of the 70s, and it was the most, you know, and lived in a tent, did the whole milk the cow thing, trapped fish on the beach. It was the most vivid summer of my life. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. And then I got my first job in TV and I wasn't a hippie anymore.
The commune life was okay for one summer, but that was about it?
About it. Yes, it was. I mean, it was actually truly an extremely interesting experience. It really was. I think that I learnt some interesting things. That one of the things I learned is that women are really practical beings and men may be less so, depends on the individual person. But that summer men did a lot of sitting around and talking and the women actually fed the children and did things. But I was married also at that time to an extremely practical person, and we had a lot of, it was extraordinary. It was vivid. It was intense. It was emotional. You know, we had a go at building a house in the bush. And I dreamed of, you know, Maoris from 1,000 years ago kind of walking through the bush around us at night. It was extraordinary. It was extraordinary.
There's that imagination, which no doubt we'll come back to a number of times through this hour. But tell us about your first job in TV. It wasn't highfalutin.
No, not at all. Not at all. In fact, the very first job, because we really had to go up to Auckland as it was then. Auckland was closer than Wellington from the Coromandel. Look, we lived in this pretty fancy tent. It was a very, very nice tent. It had two rooms.
And, I love that idea.
It was a fancy tent. But nonetheless, how, you know, naive were we? We actually managed to plonk the tent where there was a little water course, and it was dry at the time. And then it rained and it wasn't dry. So we had two little floods through the tent, and the mattresses got very soggy, and so we kind of went, you know, this ain't that much fun. So we ran away to Auckland, notionally for the winter. And the first job I got, because my husband wanted a pot full time, and I thought that was great, and our daughter at that time was like 2.5. So we were able to swap, because the first job I got when we got up there was teaching. And I took my way into teaching on the strength of an arts degree, which is hilarious. I'd never taught before in my life. And they gave me a class of kids to do remedial maths. Well, I was about 3 pages ahead of the kids. Never good at maths. Not then, not now. But, there was an ad in the paper, you know, props buy I wanted. So I was so fortunate on the strength of a degree that I'd fiddled around with, I was able to talk my way in. Now, a props buyer, you know, I don't know, for your listeners, I'm sure lots of people know what a props buyer is and does, but lots of people don't. And it's like the props buyer, you get a script, and if the script says he gives her a bunch of flowers, then the props buyer is responsible for sourcing not one but 3 bunches of flowers in case something happens to the first and the second wilts under the lights and you've always got a third sort of thing. And you talk to the director and you go, so should it be roses? Should it be lilies? Should it be this? Should it be that? So out you go and you buy the flowers for the scene and anything else that's required in the scene. And you're also there if you're dressing the sets, which means you're putting stuff in before the cameras roll. You might be there at 4 a.m. putting that bunch of flowers in a vase or putting the books on the shelves or doing whatever to dress the set.
It actually sounds kind of fun, but it's not.
It was such fun. It was such fun. I couldn't believe I got paid. I got paid.
Essentially to go shopping.
It was great. And what's more, the studio, you know, the first time I walked, I walked through the place where they were building the sets, the scenery workshop, and I sniffed the raw wood, you know, because when raw wood is cut, especially plywood, there's a kind of a cinnamon smell, I think, from the heat of the stuff as it goes through the wood. So my nostrils opened and then I walked into this set and the lights were being turned on and I came home. That's how it felt.
A kind of religious experience.
Yeah, it was. Well, yeah. I described it. It was my church. I didn't know that. I didn't know that. So that was pretty nice. No, I had a fabulous time.
So when did you think buying things is fun? This is great, but I want to be pulling the strings. I want to write my own stuff.
I didn't want to be an Indian. I didn't. I worked out really quickly it was more fun being a chief than an Indian. It took a long time not to be an Indian. You know, it takes anybody any time. You can't be a chief immediately. I was arrogant enough to believe that I could be a chief quickly. Well, it took about 6 years, I reckon. I'm just trying to think. No, maybe, yeah, about 6 years. And those 6 years were well spent, even though a lot of it I kicked against because I didn't like drudgery. Going shopping's fun, but it does run out of steam. But that was when I wrote my first script because the scripts, this, for those that know New Zealand television in the mid to late 70s, who are probably not a big part of anyone's audience these days, this soap opera was called A Going Concern. And it was set, it was all about the lives and loves of the people who ran Joypan Plastics. Now, I can imagine trying to pitch a soap opera today and go, I've got this great idea, you'll never, it's set in, wait for it, a plastics factory. You know, what were they thinking? Anyway, I didn't know any better.
And, you mean Hollywood? No, wait, hang on a second.
I didn't know. But what was wonderful for me was, my feeling was that a lot of us who were beginning to make drama in New Zealand at that time, especially later when I came to Australia again and we were all making drama together, a lot of us were holding hands with no real idea of what we were doing, which was a fun way to learn. though somewhat disastrous at times. But I stuck my hand up and thought, even I recognised at that time, arrogance again, but I didn't think the scripts were much good. And by that time, I knew the characters, and we were doing, you know, a number of half-hour episodes on the go. So it was, you had to kind of get it together. And so I stuck my hand up and said, could I write a script or two? Now, in the end, I wrote only a couple, but I wrote them on the props typewriter out the back between scenes.
Oh,
it's
you're
very naughty.
You're listening to Posey Graham Evans, the naughty Posey Graham Evans, who's a creator of some of Australia's favourite television shows, including this one.
In a world of dust and sweat, five very different women, free of spirit and full of heart, are making a go of Drover's Run.
Today I'm going to blend right into the crowd.
Two sisters, separated as children.
So I guess we need to talk about what we're going to do with the property.
Reunited after years apart.
Dad and I worked this place for 20 years and not one word from you.
It's down to them to learn to get along, to keep the place alive.
You left us.
From shearing time.
You so remind me of a girl I went to school with.
To the big muster. To the relationships of those around them.
Oh my God, I'm in a Jane Austen novel!
You'll be drawn into the drama.
You would never have tried this on my father, and you're not getting it past me. You're fired, that's it.
The humour.
I can ride. Great. Pony Club.
MacLeod's Daughters.
And drawn into the drama, Australia was.
You know what? I can put a picture to every. That was the first promo. That sent shivers down my spine. And I can see each one of the pictures. I can. I was so furious at the time because I thought they'd given away the whole plot. But my God, everybody turned on. It was stunning.
And it. Speaking of pictures, that's where it all started, with one photograph.
Yeah. Look, it really did. And you know what? It came from. And I tried to track down this article, the very germ of the idea. Somebody wrote about, and I it was a Weekend Magazine article in a national paper, I think, or it was the Bulletin, and I'm really not sure to this day what it was, but it was about girls droving in, guess where, the Northern Territory. And it was about women being taught to drove cattle the old-fashioned way. And the article talked about things like, the thing is, you give a boy a motorbike and tell him to round up cows, and a 19-year-old boy will get on that thing and go, yee-haw, and scare the cows to death. You say the same thing to a woman and you give her a horse, and she knows instinctively not to hurry the cows with the calves, but she deals with them in a different way. And this article just got me going. And it was a photograph. It was a photograph. It was a bunch of girls hanging up. I mean, it's really true. I've been asked about this, but I can see the picture again now. It was this bunch of girls hanging over a five-bar gate, and they had big hats on, big grins, and there were cattle in the foreground and dust was rising. And I thought, yes, you know, the cobalt blue skies, and there's an eternal story. And as soon as you say to anyone, best pitch in the world, bunch of girls running a cattle station, can't you see it? I can see it. And it took a long time for other people to see it. Oh, Lord.
Yeah, it wasn't, it the pitch wasn't as easy as all that. And
no,
it wasn't so easy to get the financial backing. What did you have to do to get it up?
Look, the thing is, the way things work in this country and always have, why television producers in this country are good, is that we are totally accustomed, A, to making a dollar stretch that squeaks in terms of international money. You know, people laugh when you tell them, if you tell them, and you're stupid if you do, I reckon, what you make something for. That's one thing. We're taught how to, I think experience teaches you how to make the best use of the dollars you have. And one of the reasons you do that is because no network in this country will pay you 100% of what it costs to make a drama. They'll give you what's called a pre-sale. Pre-sale is a chunk of money, but it's not the whole budget. And then it's up to the producer to go and find the rest. And if you want to make a big thing, and I think you suffer a lot to get television drama on the screen, and I can't see the point of doing something small, because in essence, I always wanted to do epics, you know, as I slowly work towards it. I mean, didn't start out doing that, but because it's as hard to get up something small as it is to get up something big. And I feel like something big has got a better chance. I'm not very interested in procedural drama like the Cops and Docs and things. There's not, like, plenty of people are, but that's not my kind of bag. So, yes, yeah, so I had to start to cobble together the money. But it took a long time. I pitched it one summer. And again, I don't remember whether it was the end of 92 or the end of 93. But it took, I seriously don't. It took a couple of years, and they said yes. They did say yes at the pitch. I pitched to the programming board at Nine at the end of a long, hot day when they'd all had lunch, and I was the last person in the room, and I thought I was dead because I didn't think their attention would be there. But in the end, they said yes to have a go, and we were going to do a 13-part series, and then somebody lost faith. So in the end, and I still do not, because you will never hear the true story. So I was submitting all this stuff and doing budgets and doing all the rest of it, but they all lost faith. I think they were very concerned that the audience wouldn't follow the adventures of a bunch of women, because we're talking early 90s, and by that time there'd not been anything on the air like Sex and the City hadn't happened. There would, you know, there'd been very little programming that was built around women in a drama sense.
So when Nine wasn't quite prepared to take the gamble on you, yeah. What sort of a gamble did you have to take to make it happen?
Well, it came down to, we were going to do a 13-part series, yeah. Then we were going to do movies, all right, okay. Then they lost faith, so we wouldn't do that. So it came down to doing a pilot telemovie, which is like a nightmare, because a pilot, in America they do pilots, but they're off-air pilots. They'll make the pilot, they'll pay for it, then they'll decide whether to give the producer an order or not. No. Sometimes in this country you do a pilot, you show it like a Sunday night telemovie, and then the network will make up its mind about whether it's then going to do a series. And I, by the way, you know, I've been in that position myself. As you know, for a while I was head of drama at Nine, and there are reasons why you do pilot telemovies. But for the producer, it's a kick in the guts, because you put your all into making the pilot. And by the way, we did the pilot with Jack Thompson, and it was the highest rating Australian telemovie of all time, until when I was at Nine, we commissioned a show called The Alice. Again, it was a pilot telemovie. And The Alice, when it went to air, which was set in Alice Springs, outrated McLeod's by 30,000 nationally. And I was happy to resign the crown, because I thought, fair cop, you know, that's all right. But up to that point, it was enormous.
So how could it be that you would have to mortgage your house twice to get this show up when so many people have watched the pilot?
Well, no. What happened was, we had to mortgage our house to get the pilot to happen, because the reason was, we got all the way. Yes, we were going to do the pilot telemovie. Yes, the South Australian Film Corporation put money into it. Yes, I got Jack Thompson to play Jack. And by the way, when we made the series, we started again, and Jack wasn't in it. And the reason was, because after it went to air, I'll tell you about the mortgage in a minute. After the pilot went to air, and it blitzed everything in sight. Went to air Mother's Day 1996, a perfect time slot. They said to me, well, of course, the only reason people watched was that Jack Thompson was in it playing Jack. Now, we killed Jack Thompson's character at the second commercial break. And the reason was, I knew that if Jack was on screen, he's so charismatic, that it would become Jack McLeod's story, not the story of his daughters. So I thought they were wrong. But to get it together, it was awful, because what happens when you're putting money together is you do it as a patchwork. And then there's endless, you get some money from here and you get some money from there. And, you know, I had a patchwork quilt of money from the South Australian Film Corporation, money from an overseas distributor, money from the network, a bit of money from somewhere else, like we'd sold it to New Zealand in advance. I don't know, you know, it was like a nightmare. And they were all, it was taking a very long time to get all the documentation together. It always does. People argue in nitty-gritty about, you know, and when you're dealing with, like, the distributor was in England, and that means talking overnight and talking to their lawyers, and their lawyers talk to your lawyers who talk to the, it goes on. And we couldn't get the final documentation signed, but we had to roll it, because we had this pay or play deal on Jack Thompson. He had a window. And so the South Australian Film Corporation said to us, it's all right, you can go into pre, we'll cash flow the pay or play deal with Jack. But the problem is, if you roll something before all the final documentation is signed, someone's going to have to pick up the tab if, for instance, you can't get people to agree to the last things. And that often happens, believe me. Things fall over on the night before you start shooting sometimes.
And that person became you?
That's right. we had to go guarantor for the South Australian Film Corporation for the pay or play deal on Jack Thompson, which was not shabby money. God.
Boy. So far away already we are from that summer in the commune. Let's just put the flowers back in our hair for a moment. You are listening to Bosie Graham Evans, the creator of McLeod's Daughters and co-creator of High Five and also a novelist. We'll be hearing more about that in a moment. Bosie Graham Evans is our guest in the guest room. Barely alive. I took the train to Richmond that fell. It was a time I remember oh so well. And I might let you back announce this one, Posey Graham Evans, because you just said my life history is slapping me in the face.
Yeah, look, just I remember listening to that song when my daughter was teething, driving around in the Adelaide Hills in the combi through the mist, singing along because she wasn't going to go to sleep and I wasn't going to go to sleep that night. And she went, she didn't cry when the music was on. She liked, she didn't, I don't think she liked me singing that much, but it helped us both anyway. Amazing. I love that. It took me immediately back to that time and place. That's all.
Amazing. You're listening to Bosie Graham Evans. She's the creator of some of Australia's best known and favourite television shows. And she's also a novelist. And she is our guest in the guest room. Now, Bosie, you described some of the drama and heartache involved, not in the drama itself, but in getting the drama to the screen. I'm talking about McLeod's Daughters. But once you have got the funding and it is given the green light, how do you go about creating the actual on-screen drama and the characters that extend over seasons?
It's interesting. Because we did the pilot in 96 and the series didn't roll till 2001, we did something like, you know, mechanically, we did something like 12 budgets. We looked at shooting at Queensland. We looked at shooting in South Australia. We looked at shooting everywhere you can think of. But I kept wanting to come back to where we shot in South Australia. And that caused dramas of its own because I needed to convince the network that I could shoot in one place and post-produce and write in another, which was Sydney. How do you do it? Well, the thing is, you got to work with the best. The thing is about television is a group activity. To make series like McLeod's, a big series, I added it up one day and I reckon when you count every single person who's involved, it's never mind the on-set crew and the cast with the script department, because you need a script factory, because once you press that button, the biggest taxi meter in the world is ticking over. And to mix the metaphor, it's a manufacturing process. You know, there's a number of stages you have to go through, from finding the locations, but then you've got to write the scripts in stages, then you've got to shoot it, then you've got to post-produce it, then you've got to deliver it, then you've got to promote it. So writing the script is a part of it, but there's a whole bunch of things that go on. So it's a group activity. You have to assemble the group. That means you've got to find, first and foremost, there are two lots of people you've got to find. You've got to find the right cast. And when we finally got the green light on the script, an order for the first series, I looked for the cast over three sweltering months right at the end of the year 2000. And I went everywhere to look, including New Zealand. And we ended up, ironically, with quite a few New Zealand actors. It was just the way it worked out. And then at the same time, you are getting the script process rolling. Now, casting is incredibly important to me. I think Sidney Pollack said this. He's one of my heroes. He made Tootsie. He's an amazing man. He's dead now. But one of the things he said was casting is 80% of the success of anything. Now, I used to think, that's rubbish, because I've always gone, no, it's got to be the script. The truth is, you can have the best script in the world. If you cast it wrongly, if there's no chemistry there, you're dead. So it took a long time to find the cast whilst we were rolling the scripts. And I was working with quite a large script department and a script producer. And that's when it all begins. That's when, as the producer, you have to, it's like rolling logs down the stream. You have to throw all the logs into the river, and then you have to balance, and you have to get those logs successfully to the river mouth, and you can't fall off. So there's a lot of rolling to be done, a lot of juggling to be done.
And how closely are you as a producer working with the script writers to create that?
Thigh deep. Because having fought for so long and so hard to make this thing happen, you think I was going to just hand it over? I don't think so. So that means you're working 18-hour days and you're reading every stage of the script. You're reading the story outline, the scene breakdown, the first draft, the second draft, the editor's draft, the script producer's draft, the director's notes. And then, of course, you sit in the edit room with the director and the, you know, and then the network comes in and they've got their notes, and then you get into the mix. And the mix is always my reward, because by that time you've got the beautifully graded pictures, it's all together, it's looking wonderful, and you hear the elements of the mix come onto that track. And we were writing songs for it as well, which made me cry every time I heard them. And the thing is that by the time I'd heard the first mix and it was done and dusted, I was exhausted, but by Christ, I'm sorry for those people who think I have just blasphemed. It meant so much to me. It meant so much to me because we got there.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering too how it seems as though you're so attached to their characters that you would have been if you're crying with as you're writing the songs and hearing them, then you would have also been shedding those mother of the bride tears when they get married and devastated when a character dies.
Oh, look, the thing is, I think they talk about conviction politicians. Well, I think there are conviction producers. There are lots of different kinds of producers. There are people who put the deal together. And without them, you know, I'm not that, I learnt to like the deal. Yeah, it's not fair. I do quite like the deal. But essentially, for good or ill, I'm a person who lives or dies by what I do. That means I cannot be indifferent. I have been trained over time to take the knocks less and to enjoy the triumphs more and to rock and roll with the anxiety that this all brings. But you have to be, it seems to me, it has to be important to you. Now, that's not to say that I can't stand back and give measured criticism, because that's also what you're there to do. You're there to take the script apart with the script producer, and that's what you do at every stage. This works, this doesn't work. But you have to be that schizophrenic being. You have to be passionately involved and still have the helicopter eye view. That's what the producer does. That's why it's hard. It ain't easy.
I'm curious, Posey. I was thinking about this. I was wondering how often in drama does a character get killed off for as a result of natural dramatic causes? And how often is it as a result of the actor wanting to move on?
Well, very interesting. I think it's harder and harder in this case to hold the cast in Australia now, because there's the siren call of Hollywood always. And, you know, Ryan Kwan-ten is a great case in point. He did True Blood, and he's become a star in the States.
He does really well in True Blood.
Yeah, and you know,
mostly shirtless, which is fabulous.
Yeah, I haven't watched all of True Blood, but I admire it as an artifact, if you like, and as a thing that's brilliantly put together. So I think it's harder and harder for producers in this country to hold on to their cast past around about three series, because that's generally speaking, a savvy agent will not, because they know, a savvy agent knows that television is a star maker, and they don't always pick successes, but if they're any good, they'll get the smell that a series has got something, and they'll want their cast to be in it, or their client to be in it. But in the end, they'll not want them to do more than a small amount, so that they want a star. And stars are rare. There's lots of really talented people out there who are fabulous, really, really, really good practitioners. A star is something else. And that's what television can do. A television series can create stars, and should. That's the role of television, it seems to me, is to teach people. And I love so casting unknown actors.
When you see a drama happen, just in this idea of, natural dramatic causes versus the actor wants to leave,
you would expect them to leave within three seasons. Let me give you a great example. The sister who played, the woman who played the sister, Claire McLeod, fantastic actress, Lisa Chappell, a New Zealander. Now, the thing is, it was a great, great and indelible role. It really was. But that character, Claire and Tess between them, were a great foil for one another, night and day, you know, light and shade. Claire was basically, I've always thought of her as a bloke in girls' clothes. That's who Claire was. She had all the honour of a man, of a particular kind of bloke, a country bloke. She wasn't gay, but she was a mannish woman with great courage, wonderful character. The thing is, Lisa's life moved on. She got married. We were shooting in South Australia. It was very hard for the cast because naturally an actor wants to be where the action is. They want to be going to first night premieres. They want to be seen. They want to, you know. So we were down in Adelaide. Now, I think most of the people who worked on McLeod's adored the show, and that goes for the cast as well. But their lives were difficult because often they didn't live in South Australia, and so that meant that they were doing a lot of flying backwards and forwards, as I was. I lived in Sydney, and I lived my life on a plane. That's why I wrote the songs, because it was the white noise, I guess. So the time came when we could not persuade Lisa to stay. She just didn't want to stay. She wanted to move on and do other things. She just married. She wanted to move from South Australia, and that was it. That was the way it was going to be. So we sat down, and we knew that that character on screen, the audience would never believe that Claire McLeod would walk away from Drover's Run. So we bit the bullet. We went, we will give her the most memorable death on screen that can be invented. We will make the most riveting and memorable television that we can. And we did. The episode where Claire dies and the funeral episode afterwards, Australia cried. And you would have thought I personally murdered that character. Oh, it was unbelievable. And people said, oh, that's it, McLeod's is gone. It'll never work again. Rubbish. We had higher ratings after Claire left the series because people wanted to know what we were going to do.
It seems as though we go through periods of boom and sort of boom and bust when it comes to homegrown Australian drama.
Yeah.
Watching from the sidelines more now, where do you think it's at?
I think there are some great things out there, and I think it's interesting. You know, after McLeod's went to air, something like 9 or 12 or 13, I can't remember, some number of shows, one after another, fell over and died. And Kerry Packer, who was a very wise bloke, was very much of the Hollywood philosophy that you get one tent pole for about 10 failures. And then it picked up again. And I think we're getting some stuff, you know, in the last couple of years that have come to air. The Underbelly shows are a phenomenon. They're not my style of show, but again, I think they're magnificently made. You know, every bit of them is beautifully made, beautifully made. Pack to the Rafters has gone bang. People love it. But then there've been lots of, you know, kind of lukewarm things. Again, this is me talking because I'm not a great fan of procedural drama. I don't really watch it, and so I'm not the best person to comment on it. But the procedural cop shows that have been going to air on 10, on 9, they do okay, and they have very loyal and devoted audiences, but they haven't fired. They haven't sort of captured the audience's imagination the way that a Pack to the Rafters has. But, you know, I think it's always going to be the way. I think it's always going to be the way, because success is a strange conjunction of things. The star shines. You know, something, the light comes down and something works. It's like the Australian cricket team. You know, for years we were brilliant and now we can't get arrested. So there needs to be renewal. New people will be found. Will it be a grind? Will there be failures? You bet. Will they come back? You bet.
What was it like to work for Kerry Packer? Was he as tough as they say?
Of course he was. He was an emperor. But, you know, he had a great sense of humour. He liked women. He was outrageous. I only knew him not well right at the end of his life. I wished I'd known him earlier. That's all I can say. He's indelible. I'll never forget him.
A record of real life. A record of real life. The Guest Room with Kate O'Toole on ABC local radio across the territory.
So you've done heaps of interesting things in your life, including spending time growing up in the war zone that was Cyprus.
Yeah. My father, an Australian, was an RAF pilot in the Second World War. Like so many, he ran away. He became a Spitfire pilot, ran away to war. He was a little warrior. And his last posting was Cyprus. And we came from Cyprus to Australia. You know, when we went there, it was paradise. And when we left, we were living surrounded by barbed wire.
And tell us about that Christmas day when you were 12.
Yeah, well, there'd been riots in the city, and somehow a girl was sent to us, an English girl whose husband, who had been a Turk, had just been shot in front of her. And she was clutching the jacket that he had worn, and it was covered in blood and with bullet holes, and she wouldn't let go of it, and she was crying. And, you know, This scars me to this day, but it's been productive to think like this because I'm so shocked still that my response was, she spoiled Christmas Day for us.
You but know, that's what happens when you're young.
I know. And in fact, it's good that it stays with me because I think it's a reminder that you can be too obsessed with yourself. God, that was a wake-up call.
Your dad was a pretty interesting fellow, though.
He was.
Tell me about the tunnel that your dad dug The Great Escape.
Yeah. Well, not the Great Escape. It was the... Look, my father was this little blue-eyed Celt. He was only about 5'6", and he was quite a silent man. So I didn't really know about this because, like so many of his generation, he didn't talk about what he did. Anyway, yes, my father was one of the people who was in Stalagluft, I want to say three, but I'm not sure, who there was a great escape organised through using a wooden horse and an exercise horse. And they used to cart this thing out every day with two men hanging inside. And the men would go down and dig a tunnel. And my father was one of those people who was rostered on to dig because he was one of the lightest men in the camp, I suppose, because he was... only little and they didn't feed them that much. And so, yes, that's what he did. And then they drew lots to see who would escape. And he wasn't one of the people who was able to escape on that occasion. And, of course, in a way, that saved his life because so many of them were shot. But, you know, it doesn't end there. My father was also one of the things he did when he was at the RAF. The first time we came to Australia, I was a little kid, and he was sent to Adelaide where, guess what, he was the joint commanding officer with the people who set up all the nuclear tests on, you know, out in the Pacific. And so he was one of the people who went out there and kind of turned his back on the blast, covering his eyes with his hands, not quite, but close. And again, he would never talk about any of that. And he accepted that absolutely as part of his duty. And I think one of the things that I was given a couple of legacies from my parents, and one of them was my father just got on with it and he committed himself to the death, which sounds ridiculously serious as something, you know, for someone who ended up making commercial drama. But the thing is, I was given that thing: if you do it, do it.
You had to move around a lot as a kid, and sometimes moving schools is not easy. Mm. You'd run away to the library for solace. What's it? It must feel good to be an author and providing solace for others in your books now.
Yes, and in fact, you know, like the lady who rang up earlier and talked about the dressmaker. There's a small plug, I shouldn't do it, but there you go. It's so wonderful. It's such an act of faith. You know, the book took me 3 years to write in this most recent, and I'm in love with words, you know. Words are a sort of a drug. They're an intoxicational thing. And when you write a book and you lose faith, my experience is, and this may not be other people's, but I lost faith so many times writing that book. And it was a tough experience for me, and I wasn't sure if it was any good. So when someone, they buy your book and you get feedback from them, I can't tell you what it means. It means a great deal. And yes, the library helped me. I went to 14 schools and I was always the outsider and I hated it. But books were friends. Doesn't that sound pathetic? But it's
no,
true.
No, not to me, although that might be pathetic too. Now, The Dressmaker is about a woman who builds a business and she's a strong woman and she's surrounded by other very important female characters. I'm drawing the parallels here with McLeod's and a strong woman surrounded by other strong characters. Is it important for you as a woman in writing in general to show us these strong characters?
Well, yes, because look, I think women are. Here we go. I can only write from my point of view. I happen to be a woman. It seems to me that because I'm a woman, it may be that I understand women better than I understand men. That's not to say I don't like men. They're pretty important in my life. But I think women tend to get a bit airbrushed out of history because we're the ones who have the children. If you have a child, you know, you're taken out of the world a bit. And, you know, there's plenty much more important thinkers than me who've had much more to say about that than anything that I can do. But I'm interested. I like writing about women. I think women are the tent poles that hold so much up. And the power, resilience and the power to endure are qualities that I think are fundamental to life. And I think women do exhibit that, not to say men don't. It's just I'm in this vein because I keep coming back to it. I don't know why. It's just an interest of mine. And the other thing is there's this great book called Too Soon Old, Too Late Smart, written by a man called Livingston. One of the things he says in that, and this is a mantra for me, disaster is the only thing that happens fast. Success in life doesn't happen fast. You have to build it. I think you have to earn it. And success is relative anyway. You know, many people have different versions of what success might mean. And my feeling is we now live in a world which gives people expectations of instant success equals instant happiness. And I think that's bullshit, pardon me.
That's quite all right, Posy Graham Evans. We will have to leave it there. There are 1,000 more questions I could ask. I haven't even spoken to you about co-creating High Five and a number of other things and your interest in history and mythology and 1,000 other stories you could be telling us today, but for time, which I'm sorry for. But thank you so much for joining us, Posy Graham Evans.
Kate, it's been fun.
Posy Graham Evans, the creator of a few shows you might have heard of, like McLeod's Daughters, like High Five. She has 16 Logies under her belt, and she's a writer and producer for her own production company. She's also a novelist. Her latest book is called The Dressmaker.
This has been the Northern Territory Guest Room. Listen live each weekday from 11 a.m. Territory time, or go to abc.net.au/Darwin or /Alice Springs to hear more.